Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889, and by French Market Coffee, locally roasted in New Orleans for 125 years. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. If you're like me, you like knowing where your food comes from. On this week's show, we hit the road to tour a variety of farms that do everything from growing fresh produce to raising colonies of honeybees. We begin in Princeton, Louisiana, where visionary farmer Evan McCommon of Mahaffey Farms is making innovative changes to his multi-generational family farm. Evan gives us a tour and even introduces us to his heritage breed pigs. Then, we visit Gourmet Mushrooms in Sonoma County, California, which is more of a science lab than an actual farm. And when it comes to making the sweet liquid gold that is honey, the busy bees do most of the work. As we explore the life of honeybees, don't worry, nobody gets stung. We're meeting our farmers and eating their wares on this week's Louisiana Eats.
If I start focusing on money and wealth building, I think I'll neglect the principles that are going to build it the right way. I didn't get into this to get rich, but I think we can build something that can take care of our family.
That's Evan McCommon on his family's land, Mahaffey Farms. Located outside of Bossier City, Mahaffey Farms has been in Evan's family since 1927 and thrived as a working farm for decades before Evan's great uncle passed away.
The path of least resistance was, if these pine trees are trying to grow here, let's let them do it. So we started raising pine timber.
Which they grew until the timber economy bottomed out a few years ago.
I'm like, what are we going to do? You know, I had all my eggs in one basket. So how can I diversify? How can I figure out other ways to keep this family land alive and invigorate it?
Evan started looking for solutions and found that the most diverse farms were usually on savanna pastures.
Basically, what savanna means is widely spaced trees. That a forest is a dark, foreboding, dark place, you know, and really savanna has grass, has multiple layers of different size plant species growing together. And it's actually because of that, you basically have more surface area and you're collecting more solar energy than any other system on the planet in a savanna, which supports more species. There's the three major environments of forest, open land, and water. And where the three of those come together is where you're going to have the most abundant life. So we're trying to create as much of that as possible. And the savanna is the most abundant life-producing system we can mimic in nature.
So he started the conversion, trimming back trees and clear-cutting some dense forest. But the land was always Evan's first priority.
It's pretty exciting. I mean, we're starting to see results. If you look over there, I mean, literally, I think maybe we're pushing 8 months now. That was just thick pulpwood pine. And look at it, it's just chest-high grass with dappled oaks, and the oaks are going to provide master forage for our pigs.
Evan modeled his North Louisiana farm after Joel Salatin's Polyface Farms in Western Virginia. You may know Joel Salatin from The Omnivore's Dilemma and Food, Inc. Joel offers internships for aspiring farmers at Polyface Farms, and Evan was fortunate to have studied there with the legendary farmer.
I'm not bashful about saying I copied everything exactly almost. The way I built my pens, the way I built my eggmobile. And that's kind of like, you know, well, you know, you're just copying Joel Salatin. Well, yeah, that's like a basketball player copying Michael Jordan, of course.
Exactly. No need to reinvent the wheel.
No. And
if
it's working
great. If
you
learn from the master.
Right.
Yeah.
And we're making adjustments for our southern climate. You know, it's a little bit different than the Shenandoah Valley here. a little bit different soil, a little bit different heat. And so just little minor changes.
One of the big things he's adopted is a group of movable pasture pens for his chickens, known as chicken tractors. They're 10 by 12 foot shelters made out of aluminum siding that come up to your knees.
And the way they work is you move the chickens every day, and this gets them access to fresh green grass on pasture, bugs, the environment that a chicken's supposed to be in and the nutrition that they're supposed to get. Instead of being locked in a dark house on top of their own excrement, these are moved every day to fresh, clean ground off of yesterday's manure. And the way Joel Salatin designed them was also a production method to where you can go out and one person can move 1,000 birds in half an hour. And so this is about 300 birds, and I can move them in about 20 minutes. And that includes feeding them, watering them, moving the pens, everything.
But chickens aren't the only animals Evan's raising on the farm. He's got cattle, goats, and pigs.
We have four groups of pigs on the farm right now. And we don't just raise red wattles. Like I said, I'm into hybrid vigor. We have a lot of crossbreeds. We have red wattles mixed with Hampshires and blue butts. And we have some pure red wattles, and some of them are, we don't even know. Just pigs. A pig is a woodland creature. They are exceptionally good at taking, putting them in the forest and turning the soil over and creating just the right amount of disturbance to invigorate for us converting from timber or in forest to a savanna pasture. They're the perfect animal to help us do the work.
Pigs are an important part of the mix at Mahaffrey Farms. Some were feeding in their pens while others roamed free, grazing in the shade of the tall pines.
I like to look at old livestock books and see what did the pigs look like back in the 1920s and 30s. Because back then, you know, there hadn't been bred for confinement facilities. Everybody was raising pigs outside. Let's just find old genetics, closest to the wild source. That's another way to look at it. This is where they're meant to be. There's a reason why a pig has a plow on the end of its nose. It's so that it can forage for roots and bugs and all these different things. I like flavor in my food, and raising things on pasture and letting the animals get to maturity. A 300-pound pig rather than a 200-pound pig actually develops a better flavor over time, especially when you finish them with acorns or on pasture with real green forage and real food instead of just corn. And that's what their meat's supposed to taste like.
As much as possible, Evan lets Mother Nature do the heavy lifting while he attends to the farm's management.
So like if you add pigs to your operation, that encourages 8 more species, or it will support them. So by putting these pigs here, we're gonna bring in different types of birds that we're gonna, you know, rely on them for different things, and different insects and different plants are gonna thrive with the addition of each species. So I'm excited about having just thousands and thousands of, I want this place to be just the Garden of Eden is what I'm trying to build.
As we crossed back through the chicken pasture, we got a great overview of Mahaffrey Farms. A small lake was to our right, the savanna pasture to our left, and a dense timber forest could be seen on the horizon. Of the 1,100 acres available, only 300 have been converted to farmland.
We're still going to keep timber as our mainstay, and that's our primary product. And if this continues to expand, you know, in 10 years from now, this 300 acres will be a very prosperous savanna. And then we'll be looking at the next block of land that's adjacent and say, okay, where is it in the management plan? Is it ready for some thinning and savanna work? That's the thing, is it's a really a legacy for me, is that my uncle left this for us. He left this thing, and the family, not by any fault of our own, but just no one was here to do it. And so now I'm taking over and saying, okay, we're going to keep this family legacy in this farm, and we're going to turn it into something that we're proud to pass on. And then I'm happy to see something real get done with it instead of it turning into another real estate development. We don't want to see more suburban sprawl. We want to see sustainable agriculture sprawl is what I want to see.
Evan McCommon sells fresh produce and pasteurized meats at farmers markets in the greater Shreveport area. You can also buy directly from his family farm in Princeton, Louisiana. Visit MahaffeyFarms.com for more information. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats.
My name is Jordan Bantwell, and I'm the co-owner of Southbound Gardens. We're an urban farming company that does many things, most notably our nursery, but we're also urban chicken farmers.
3 years ago, in the shadow of US 90 and the Crescent City Connection, on a keyhole lot almost invisible from the street, Jordan Bantwell and his partner Ian Wilson started Southbound Gardens, an urban farm in the heart of New Orleans' Central City.
It's kind of convenient for our purposes because it's difficult to develop. There might actually be a house here if it weren't for the inconvenient situation, having it be a keyhole lot.
Would you take us on a tour of your garden space?
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so we have several fruit trees, many of which we were lucky enough to have planted before our time. There was a legendary gardener named Philip here long before we got to the space. And there's been a series of gardeners that have come through this place since. And it's been in our hands for the past 3 years. But we've got apple trees, peach trees, papayas, we have fig trees, we have a bay laurel, which is supplying several restaurants actually with all of their bay needs. Four citrus trees, sugar cane, oh, there's another fig, a grapevine, blackberry patch, a couple bananas. That banana was planted when we got here.
And does yield edible bananas?
It does. There's some growing that should be ripe by the fall right now. And they're unlike any banana you've ever tasted from the grocery store. It honestly tastes more like banana-flavored candy, which I always thought was such a weird flavor. I never liked it when I was growing up as a kid. I picked out the banana runts until I tried these bananas and realized that flavor actually has a real analog as far as bananas. In the real world, and they're delicious, they're amazing. They're more fibrous and a lot sweeter than a regular banana. So this is shiso, also known as perilla. And shiso is a Japanese herb, it's common in sushi. This all came from one single plant. We didn't realize how aggressive it is. One single plant, and it spread across the entire farm after one season. All this right here is red leaf amaranth. Amaranth has been eaten for thousands of years, mostly for the grain. We do this one more as a leaf spinach, and we sell that to restaurants. Mountain spinach is one of the common names. No relation at all to spinach. Here we have the padron peppers, which is said to be kind of like a Mexican version of a shishito pepper. Supposedly more of a sweet than a hot pepper, but I beg to differ.
It looks like you've got an enviable fig tree back there.
We cut that thing way back. Figs are notorious for being cut back and then coming back stronger than ever and producing a really good crop the next year.
And what's that, a little sugar cane?
Yes, we're growing sugar cane. Another really easy to grow crop, actually. You just lay down a stick of sugar cane and it'll sprout roots and put up leaves and make new canes. Growing in and around the apple mint here, we have a Roselle hibiscus plant, also known as a cranberry hibiscus because of the kind of tangy, almost cranberry-like flavor of the leaves and the calyxes, which are kind of the outside leaves of the seed pod. And if you taste the leaf here, it's got a wonderful flavor.
It's kind of citrusy.
Yeah, it's citrusy. It's got that tang. And, you know, it's a very nutritious plant, really commonly eaten in Southeast Asia. And we're happy to be sharing it here in Southern Louisiana.
Any chefs catch on with this yet?
We just started marketing it. We're probably going to be giving out some free samples to let them see what they can do with it. But, you know, it's great cooked down or raw in a salad. One thing we're trying to do here is maybe stretch people's palates a little bit and introduce plants they're maybe not necessarily used to, but that might actually grow really well in our climate and could become really suitable to our culinary culture.
So you all do a CSA year-round?
Yes, we do. We have a year-round growing season, so why not do a year-round weekly produce box? people can sign up for any number of increments starting from a month all the way up to 3-6 months. And you can sign up on the website, or you can just drop us a line via email. And you can come pick it up whenever we're at the farmer's market. We're usually at the Saturday Crescent City Farmer's Market downtown in the CBD, as well as the Thursday market in the American Can Company parking lot in Mid-City. We also open up the nursery on Sundays. You can come visit us there, pick up your box, and do some plant shopping.
Oh, that's great fun. And for those of you who might want to come visit you on Sunday, where do they come?
So that's 4221 South Robertson. That's uptown near Ferret and Napoleon. We open up the nursery every Sunday from 10 to 1.
Thanks so much, Jordan.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you, Poppy.
Jordan Bantwell, co-owner of Southbound Gardens. When we come back from a short break, we'll explore farming both underwater and a buzz in the sky. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and from Brennan's Restaurant. Breakfast at Brennan's, featuring Chef Slade Rushing's updated classic Creole cuisine. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, and private events at 417 Royal Street in the historic French Quarter. In Grand Isle, Louisiana, the Guerrero family farms Louisiana oysters that have lived their whole lives without ever touching the muddy bottom. They do this by utilizing an innovative floating cage system, the first of its kind in Louisiana waters. I could not resist a trip to see the family-run Caminata Bay Premium Oyster Company in action. We joined Marco Squero and his son Boris aboard their compact bay boat for a morning out on Caminata Bay.
Okay, we're going to the farm, Caminata Bay Premium Oyster Farm. It's right there by Caminata Pass, next to, in front of the island, close to the bridge, actually. It's a plot, it's like a park that the Port Commission with Wildlife and Fisheries and all the legislation, legislators from Louisiana make it happen, because it was no legislation before, so no one can have aquaculture in the state. This is the first time the law passed, I think, in 2012. So in 2013, we started doing the process, the paperwork, and then actually in 2013, would approve and start doing the infrastructure, did the anchors on this on the bottom of the sea, put the submarine lines and all the infrastructure that we need in order to grow these oysters.
Tell me a little bit about the seeding process that you take part in.
Okay, we buy the seed from the hatchery, and then we put it in a nursery on land, After they reach 4 millimeter, we start putting in the field. And from that time, it takes about 10 months probably to be market size. And the beauty of this one is that the place where we are, it gave this unique flavor to these kind of oysters. The bay is so rich in flavors, wild flower, oyster, herbs inside, the sea salty, the texture is great what happens over there at the bay. And being on 12, the first 12 inches of the surface, that's where the most of the nutrients of the sea are. So they grow faster that way. They grow in cages. The cages protect them from predators, so we don't have to worry about that. They don't have to worry about predators. Now, in order to get this nice shape, we have to flip the cages once a week. So that's a lot of hard work and take a lot of time, because we have to wait until for a nice day, a day that is not raining or it's not too many waves. They call this drying position. It's in a drying, so the oyster get dry. So it prevents the bio falling to form and also incrustation on the shell. It prevents, so that's why you see the oyster coming later on so clean.
As the boat slowed down and we began our approach to their underwater farm, I noticed several black devices about 2 feet in diameter floating on the clear water. Alongside of them were rows of white polyethylene plastic pipes jutting 7 or 8 feet out above the water. Forrest slowly navigated between the white poles, taking us over to one of the black torpedo-shaped floating devices.
Which one are you going to take? Second.
All right.
Stopping the boat, Boris and his father each grabbed one end of the device, pulling a heavy wire cage onto our boat, packed with growing baby oysters.
So this is the cage, the floating devices. It's a fish. Okay, you see what we're talking about?
Yes, exactly.
The look protection here. This is a reef for them.
So you can see, we put the seed this.
There's the little babies.
Yeah, these are from, they spawned in July. So yeah, there are little babies there for next season.
The hatchery produced, it's a mix, if you put it that way, between a diploid oyster and tetraploid. Once they mix the two, it comes a triploid. It's the same as the other oyster. The only thing is they don't spawn. It's like a seedless watermelon, the same nice watermelon, but without the seed. That's the only difference. And that allowed us to sell it whole year round, especially in summertime. Do we call it the summer crop? Because we can harvest during the summer without any problem.
And not only that, they spend all their energy growing instead of also, you know, spawning.
Yeah, instead of spawning. Yeah.
So like the meat, it stays meatier for that case, because all they do is grow and eat. So yeah, this will be for next season. The other ones are kind of heavy. We'll have to use the whole thing to pick them up.
Cool.
Yeah. That's what we see them float them deeper than these are.
Yeah, oh, yeah. So that's the difference also. Mm. So the ones that are deeper is where
ready to harvest. They're ready to harvest.
That's how you even can tell without some sort of great memory or complicated map,
right,
huh?
Exactly.
But sometimes here we have to just come over what we see, okay? We remember.
Yeah. We start usually from this side to that side. We start harvesting, yeah.
So we have an order. Yeah. You see the currents?
That's another thing. We have plenty of wind, plenty of currents, and most of the waves are on top. So every time it passes one, it keeps them kind of clean. You know, not fully clean, but it helps. Every little helps.
The tidal action out here in Caminata Bay is another part of the assistance in your farming.
Of course, and also the wind. The tidal, all the water coming from those marshlands keep the flavor, the nice flavor of the oyster and the nutrients, yes.
So each cage grows about 700? Is that, what's the yield out of each cage?
Yeah, we have it right now. We're trying the amount that we can put in it, but we know that, for example, in other parts of Canada, they grow up to 1,000 each cage. So we're kind of pushing a little bit, seeing, understanding also how it reacts, what happens here. So we put just 700. We have some of 800, we have some of 900 too. We never put 1,000, but we are trying and see what's the best amount that it can hold.
Well, you all are brave pioneers, that's the truth.
Thank you very much. Yes, we're here every day thinking, and so many nights without sleeping, just thinking on what we have here. It's not too easy, but we got a great product, we got a great response. That makes us move forward, really. People like you coming here and having this talk here, that's fantastic.
Caminata Bay Premium Oysters is a family business run by Marcos Cuero, his wife, and 2 sons. You can find Caminata Bay premium oysters at Dickie Brennan's Bourbon House and at other fine seafood restaurants in Louisiana. Visit to Napa Valley for the American Harvest Workshop, Louisiana Eats made a stop at Marshall's Farm, located in the Cake Bread Cellar's vineyards. Spencer Marshall, the beekeeping guru of Northern California, gave us a tour so we could learn more about his land of wine and honey.
Well, I'm Spencer Marshall, and I've been doing this for over 40 years. My grandmother had bees on the farm, and her mother, my great-grandmother, had bees in Yellowstone. They actually got kicked out of Yellowstone before it was a park. So, big tradition. And, you know, I was around them when I was a kid. I didn't really get into it till I was about 22, I guess. And then I just fell in love, can I say. And that's kind of a common story. People that are into bees, a lot of them, is I just fell in love. You know, it's just one of those things. It's fascinating because with chickens or a lot of other creatures, cows, you're not really involved in their life. You observe it, you maybe get their product, whatever they produce. But with bees, you are intricately involved. You're involved with keeping them strong, like a doctor. They have lots of diseases, reproducing, changing the genetics with the queens. And so you really, you know, it's not just something you observe. You're a participant. With the modern situation in the world, there's not too many bees that are making it on their own. They really need the support.
How much of an effect have you seen from the bee colony collapse issue?
Well, it's a whole new world. I mean, I started this nearly 50 years ago, so I've really watched it. When I started, I talked to the old-time guys, and they, you know, almost 50 years ago, they said, man, you ought to seen the way it used to be. Well, I'm the one saying that now, so believe me, the last few years have been tough. One of the things that's changed is we had this parasite, a couple different parasites come in this country almost 30 years ago now, from Asia, and there are a lot of chemicals out there that most beekeepers use. Most of them are not very good, I mean, as far as toxicity. And I started a program of working with the genetics, working with the survivors of those pathogens and parasites, and did pretty well. We've got to the point where we could coexist with the parasites. And because there's a behavior pattern called a clean gene that very fastidious, they get in there, they groom each other, they clean out the infected cells. But the problem now is the mites themselves, it's a little parasite, carry different viruses. And so you only need a few to start spreading these viruses. Whereas before, I could coexist with a few mites, now it's getting tough. So these hives here, for the first time this year, I am using a chemical, but it's a natural occurring chemical called thymol that knocks the mites off the bees. And you can only put it on after you pulled the honey. So the honey was pulled a few days ago from here. And so I brought a frame of honey from a hive that that was harvested before they put the thymol on. So it's tough, that's all I can say. But, you know, we're farmers, so we just keep going.
Then, Spencer took us straight to the hives to get really up close and personal with the bees. Those busy worker bees flew in and out of the hive, seemingly unbothered by our close proximity.
Now, I'm smoking them a little more than normal because I don't want anybody to get stung. We've got some hats. For those people that feel pretty comfortable. Okay, so you use a lot of materials, wood chips, burlap, old leaves, and talking about how the bees used to live in tree trunks. If they smelled smoke, They thought there was a fire. So what they do is they start gorging themselves on honey, getting ready to flee. So it doesn't calm them as much as it distracts them. So what we do is we recreate a little fire here. So these are two hives here. We left this box on top just to catch a swarm, which, and a swarm moved in, and here it is. So when the old queen flies off with half the hive, they got to find a new home. And what they'll do in the days before they do swarm, because they've got it all worked out, is they'll have scouts go out and look for a new place to go. So the day they do swarm, they have an idea where it's going on. And they'll have scouts come back and they'll talk it over and, I got a great spot. Okay, and then you'll see three or four bees go to that spot, and pretty soon you might see 20 or 30 bees. And you know there's probably going to swarm, going to move in imminently. Some spend the night even in the new location.
Some of the bees I see flying in there have a bright white stripe, kind of. Are they
some
different?
Some bees are bringing in pollen already. That's pretty funny. Amazing this time of day. Yeah. But pollen is their protein, their meat. When you see a lot of pollen going on, you know they're raising babies. But they all get a little of it. Yeah, it's... Some pollens are up to 40-45% protein.
Wow.
You're on a meatless diet or an athlete, pollen can be a good thing for you.
So now we're opening up an actual hive. Golden raw honey drips from the screens.
This is all honey. Hopefully the blue gums will start kicking in by middle of October. And see how they all got their heads down in the cells?
Yeah.
Fresh new honey.
Spencer Marshall of Marshall's Farm in Napa Valley, California. How can honey be substituted for sugar in recipes? We'll answer that question when we come right back. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from French Market Coffee. French Market Coffee's premium blend beans are locally roasted in small batches, creating a coffee that can only be called New Orleans Bold. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. How can honey be substituted for sugar in recipes? Honey is composed of two simple sugars, glucose and fructose. Your body absorbs honey differently than granulated sugar, causing a slower, more gradual rise in blood sugar. Because it has a higher level of fructose than sugar, it's sweeter, so you can use less. And because of its ability to retain water, baked goods made with honey tend to be moister longer. Here's some things to consider when substituting honey for granulated sugar. Use the same amount of honey as sugar for up to 1 cup measure. For more than a cup, reduce the honey to 2/3 or 3/4 of a cup, depending on how sweet you want it. Also, for recipes calling for more than 1 cup of sweetener, you may want to reduce the other liquids called for by 1/4 cup. Lower your baking temperature by 25 degrees and watch carefully because honey makes things brown faster. If baking soda isn't already in the recipe, add 1/4 teaspoon per cup of honey to reduce the acidity of the honey and increase your volume. And one more tip. If you're using a measuring spoon, moisten it with honey or a little oil before measuring out the honey. That way, the honey won't stick to the spoon. I'm Poppy Tooker, and honey makes for some sweet Louisiana eats. Gourmet Mushrooms was founded in Sonoma County, California in 1977. It was a small farm selling specialty mushrooms to restaurants in the San Francisco Bay Area. Since then, the company has expanded in size and distribution, harvesting 8 different varieties of organic mushrooms for specialty food wholesalers, gourmet grocers, and restaurants all across America. As part of a 4-day seminar at the American Harvest Workshop, Louisiana Eats was invited with chefs, journalists, and other food enthusiasts to tour the gourmet mushroom farm and learn about their cultivation process. Upon arriving, we were greeted by our guide, Chef Liaison Bob Engel, who began with a joke to break the ice.
So my rule is this: if I don't know the answer to a question, I will make it up, because that's the way my dad taught me. On the other hand, if I ever say I don't know, that means I can't tell you, I'm sorry. I'd have to kill you if I told you. So I don't know means I can't tell you. And any other answer I give may or may not be true. You'll never know. Okay. So let's start the tour. We're going to head all the way around to the opposite corner of the building because I want you guys to see it in chronological order the same way that the mushrooms see it.
Wow.
Mind your step. This is agriculture.
When we arrived at the building, we were welcomed by a pleasant aroma coming from a ribbon blender, mixing together ingredients called substrate, the food mushrooms need to thrive.
So from this point here, you actually see both ends of the process. There we have raw materials coming in, mostly sawdust. We're currently getting our sawdust from a lumber mill in Wisconsin. It's red oak sawdust. There are also some other things that we put in, soybean hull, wheat bran, okara for some varieties, which is the spent material from making tofu. The process is entirely organic. There's no pesticides used. There's no artificial fertilizers of any sort. So at this point here, we've got raw materials coming in. This is a batch of materials being mixed up for the morning's run. At that end there, you can see all of those bottles. The mushrooms have been harvested from those bottles, and we're going to take that substrate out of there, goes into the dump truck, goes to a company that makes soil amendments. Everything that comes out of the farm goes back to the soil. We're going to go around the corner now, and let's see what they're doing.
Around the corner, we watched as a machine packed the prepared substrate into groups of small plastic bottles as they moved down a conveyor belt.
People have been growing mushrooms on wood for thousands of years, and the original system was to drill a hole in a log, fill it with mycelium, and wait for that log to give the mushroom enough food that it will push up the part we want to eat. Somebody in the 50s in Japan started experimenting with using sawdust instead of a wood log. We're pre-chewing the food for the mushroom. Mushrooms that would take a year to start on a solid log, we can grow here in 7.5 weeks. Because the mushroom gets to envelop each grain of sawdust and just chomp up the food and do what it wants to do. We're not growing from seeds. Mushrooms don't have seeds. We're not growing from spores. We could, but it's a little more complicated than we need to be. We're growing mushrooms from mushroom. We're going to take this sawdust substrate and we're going to sterilize it. That's a pressure cooker. 14 pounds of pressure, 240 degrees of temperature. All of our substrate is sterilized. So this machine here takes that sawdust from the ribbon blender that we started at, puts it into bottles one at a time. Using a plastic bottle, we can use the bottle over and over and over again, and even at the end of its cycle, when it starts to degrade or crack or something, we can still recycle it because it's not all that hard to clean. We also put a little Dibbit stick down the center of each jar so that when we add the starter, the inoculant, that little bit of mycelium that we're going to start things from, instead of just growing from the top down, some of it drops down the middle and it grows from the inside out. Much more efficient that way. It's as if we're cloning. but we're only doing what Mother Nature does in the forest. You've heard that the largest organism on the planet is a mushroom. It's mushroom mycelium that runs through the forest floor so that if you start here and pick up DNA and walk a half mile that way and pick up DNA, you get the same mushroom. Each one of these bottles becomes a core of forest floor. We myceliate it with a little bit of the thread of the mycelium that we've kept either in a super cold, like minus 70 degree freezer, that's where we keep our library so we never lose track of these strains, or just on an agar-agar plate where we can pull a little bit off to start some spawn to start the next batch. So at this site here, we're bringing in raw materials. This door has a twin on the other side of the wall. The sterilizer goes all the way through the wall. So we load it up with these bottles, sterilize them, open it at the other end, let them cool down there. That's the cleanest area of the farm. Visitors never go there. So before we go through the second set of double doors, there's some foot baths, if you would please. You just need to get the bottoms of your feet wet. Any one of those baths will do.
In addition to the foot baths, everyone in our group was asked to put on hair nets to limit potential contamination. We all admittedly looked pretty silly, but before we had a chance to get self-conscious, we found ourselves at the germination room.
There are over 500,000 bottles here. We hand harvest 65,000 bottles a week. It gives us about 22,000 pounds of mushrooms every week, 52 weeks a year. This bottle is a really good representation of what we're doing. If you see these bottles over here, they're almost entirely brown. That's the sawdust. Those bottles behind you, almost entirely white. That's the mycelium. This bottle here is partway through that process. You see the brown sawdust at the bottom, and you see the white mycelium at the top. You also see a little bit of mycelium at the bottom, where that hole allowed the culture to start growing more rapidly. That stuff there, this stuff here, this white fuzzy stuff, that is the mushroom. The thing that we eat is not a mushroom. The thing that we eat is the fruit of the mushroom. It is the apple, not the apple tree. This is the apple tree. When you pluck a mushroom in the forest, you're only taking the reproductive apparatus, the fruit body. It's there with its stem to get the cap up into the airflow, and its gills to send spores out into the world. Once that is over, its job is done, and it starts to degrade. In this room here, all of these bottles can share springtime temperatures together, and all of our varieties can have pretty much the same kind of spring. But in order to get this mycelia to pop up with the mushroom that we want to eat, we have to do the same thing to them that Mother Nature does. We drop the temperature and raise the humidity. The mushroom thinks it's fall, and it's time to get busy. So we're going to go on now into the fall area.
In the next room, the bottles of mycelium moved down a conveyor belt where they were turned upside down and the contents at the tops of each bottle were scraped off.
So this machine here does a process called quincaillerie. In cuisine, we steal words from the French that we can't say in English. Sauté, roux. In the mushroom industry, we steal words from the Japanese, because there's no word for kinkake in English. What it's doing is it's scraping off the top about half inch. It's the driest spot, and it's the hardest spot. It's been exposed longest to the air. If there's any little contamination that's gotten in, it might be right there. So by scraping that away, we make it easier for mushrooms to come through. As we go around the corner, take a look at the modest but impressive level of technology. Every room has a CO2 meter on it. Every room has humidity and temperature dialed in for the mushroom that will give the best product. At the old farm, we had to take many different varieties, and it was like roommates at college. They might not like the same music, but they had to share a room. Here, we're able to take each mushroom and give it just the conditions that are going to make it flourish. As we go in, we're going to sort of do a conga line. So there's a corridor, and you can go down the right-hand side and come back up the left, and that way we all fit inside.
One by one, we proceeded into the first harvest room, packed with bottles, abounding with beautiful growing mushrooms.
So the room that you're in is Trumpet Royale, also known as a king oyster. As you walked in on the side, you saw some Nebbiolo Bianco. The reason it can share this condition is that is also an oyster mushroom. So both the majority of the mushrooms, the big ones in the center, Trumpet Royale, King Oyster, Pleurotus oryngii, and the ones on the white shelf over there, those are Pleurotus nebridensis. That one grows wild in Sicily, and it likes really cold conditions. So we actually cold shock that mushroom at a certain point in its development to give it the idea that it's under snow. And then we start it up again in the spring, as it were. The disco lights that you see on the nebridensis over there, that's a little experiment to see if they respond better to more light, if they respond better to white light or blue light. One of the great things about growing mushrooms this way with the very short growth cycle is that we learn quickly. We're data heavy. So if we get an idea about how to improve a mushroom, we can test it in 8 weeks. We can verify it in 16 weeks. We can see if we can scale it up in 24 weeks. And within a year, we've got a better mushroom on the shelf. If you were growing on logs with a 1 year cycle, it would take you 3 or 4 years to learn that much information. So I appreciate you folks coming. I love showing this place off because I remember what it felt like when I first walked inside. And it's a really weird, strange, wonderful farm. Thank you.
Bob Engel, chef liaison at Gourmet Mushrooms. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week when we talk with Julian Nicolini, famed co-owner of New York's Four Seasons restaurant.
We were greeting them every day. We were giving hard time to our guests every day, and they just loved it.
A hard time to the guests?
Well, of course.
Oh, like, how do you mean?
Well, you have to punish them. Because, you see, when they go to their offices and so on, they're all surrounded by yes men.
Right.
Forget it. When they go to a restaurant, they should have a little of their own medicine, you know?
Have you missed an episode of Louisiana Eats? Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com, where you can also subscribe to the podcast and take us with you wherever you go. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and from the Palace Cafe, home of crab meat cheesecake, white chocolate bread pudding, and the Black Duck Bar, sporting the largest rum collection in New Orleans, located in the historic Whirline Music Building on Canal Street. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Don't forget to find our recipes and see what we're up to at poppytooker.com. You can check us out on Instagram and Facebook as well. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.